Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another edition of Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, and in the studio with me this week is Russell Chianelli as a co-host, and we're going to be talking to a physician who is a professor of medicine at Duke University with some very special ideas about training of medical personnel, MDs, MD, PhDs. He's an oncologist by training, and he's got first-hand experience of the medical system as a patient as well as an MD. His name is Neil Spector, and Neil, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get into what you do, what you've been through, what experiences you've had, and what wisdom you've sort of garnered from your career, we'd like to find out a little bit about Neil. As a young man, or when was it that you realized that science, and therefore medical science and biomedical research, was the career that you were interested in?
Sure. Well, it occurred pretty early on. I mean, in my formative, actually preteens, my father was at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda. He was doing work in the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute on catecholamines back in the early days. And so I used to go into the lab with them all the time, you know, maybe 8 years old, 10 years old. And every once in a while, he'd let me do some experiments and, you know, play with the pipettes. And I just grew up around science. And, you know, I met Nobel Prize winners Marshall Nuremberg and Julie Axelrod very early on, and was just impressed that you know, that was something that there were so many unanswered questions and so much excitement that even in that young an age, I could tell that that was something that I was very interested in, just the intrigue of being around the lab. The other thing, too, is that we were exposed, my sister and I, who also is a physician, she's a pediatrician, at an early age to kids especially. So we used to go to the clinical center at the NIH, and on the top floor, they had an area for kids to play, and we would go and play with these kids who had rare diseases since the NIH.
Oh, these were patients also,
not sons and
daughters of people working there.
No, these were patients. So they were kids who would wear football helmets because they had such horrendous seizure disorders to protect themselves. And, you know, and so for us, my sister and I, it was nothing to see kids who, you know, came from Alaska with some strange inherited disease. So we really grew up around, you know, science, around medicine.
Okay.
So at an early age I knew, and I just continued, you know, in high school I worked in the lab, in college I worked in labs, and it became very clear. The other track that I was going to take in college was the diplomatic corps, but I think I quickly realized that law school wasn't for me. So.
Yeah, diplomacy is much more difficult than science, I think.
No bad accidents in the lab or explosions when you were a kid?
Nothing bad, yeah.
Did you publish with your father?
I did, actually. I published when I was in high school. I have two papers then, and I published later in life with my dad.
What was the work? What can you remember precisely the moment when you realized, my goodness, I've made a contribution. I'm only 14 or something.
We were actually measuring in the cerebral spinal fluid some neurotropic drugs. My father, at a time when antibodies and the use of antibodies, monoclonal antibodies in particular, for diagnostics was not what it is today. It was an area that was up and coming. And so we were developing ways to measure the effects of therapeutics in people with, you know, with psychiatric disorders. I remember going, we were living in northern New Jersey at the time. I remember driving with my dad into Bellevue Hospital at NYU in New York City and going into the psychiatric ward and, you know, being locked in behind the doors to collect cerebral spinal fluid for some of our studies.
And, wow, you've been exposed from an early age to some rather extreme conditions. I would think being in an institution with a lot of people with psychological issues would be a little scary.
It was scary at first. Actually, some of the people on the street were scarier than the ones behind the door. So,
was that New York or Washington?
That was New York, yeah.
Okay, well, so then obviously it's very clear right from T is equal to zero, you were going to be a scientist and do research. But then you went, as I understand it, you went to college for an MD degree. And in those days, I think there were still, well, there were. You could have gone for an MD, PhD, which sort of set you aside as a special type of medical practitioner. You chose not to do that, and I'd be interested, and so would our audience. What were the decision-making process in your mind then? And the advice you got, obviously, from your father.
Yeah. My father, well, I'll just start with the latter. My father, the advice from him was just do what you feel is best for you. He really never pushed me in one direction or the other. I guess the rationale for doing an MD and then at the completion of the MD and my clinical training to focus, spend time and have continued to spend time in the lab is that I really wanted to get a solid clinical training. I didn't want to have interruptions and spend, you know, 2 years in medical school and 4 years getting a PhD and then going back to the clinic. Personally, my thoughts about MD, PhD is, and actually what I tell people, undergrads who come and they ask, you know, should I get an MD, should I get a PhD, should I get an MD, PhD? You know, what I say is that that MD training is, and the clinical aspect, so once you're finished, you know, doing a residency, you know, fellowship beyond, if that's called for, is such a unique opportunity to actually see disease, you know, to see, I mean, in a sense, to ask questions based on what you see in the clinic. I mean, it's one thing to do studies in mice and cell lines and, you know, genetically contrived models. It's another thing to go to clinic and see, for example, two women with breast cancer and one woman, and for all the world, they both look exactly the same under the microscope. You know, they're the same age, the same demographics. And one gets a treatment and does incredibly well and is alive 15 years later, and the other is, you know, is unfortunately dead in 15 months. And so to, you know, to ask questions and say, well, what is it about these two women that makes the world of difference in how they respond to therapy? And then go back to the lab and try to design models to address those questions. To me, the researchers who have that perspective of the clinic and can identify interesting phenomenon, I mean, I tell people the clinic is the best laboratory you could ever imagine. You know, the people who really understand clinical medicine and can go back either in their own lab or partner with, you know, with basic scientists, those, in my mind, those are the, you know, the folks and the collaborations that tend to really do transformative work with respect to bringing science into clinical application. So I made the decision that I wanted to do, my residency was at Parkland Hospital in Dallas, which was at the time and probably still is one of the, you know, the better classical internal medicine programs around, where you just came out of that program feeling like you could take care of everything.
Going back to the two women with breast cancer, what's our current understanding about why there was the difference?
So, I mean, the current understanding now is that, you know, breast cancer is not just one uniform disease. And there's probably dozens, well, we know there's dozens of molecular subtypes. So with the explosion of, you know, genomic technologies and the ability to sequence people's, you know, genes, their DNA, we now recognize that those two women who may look for all the world like they have the same breast cancer really don't. And so based on their, you know, the mutations and their tumors, we can now subclassify breast cancer into many different types. You know, we've gone from a one-size-fits-all approach to not only making a diagnosis, like you have breast cancer, and therefore here's the classic algorithm of the treatment, to now saying you have, you know, breast cancer that has HER2 gene amplification, or you have breast cancer that is triple negative, meaning it's estrogen, progesterone receptor negative, and negative for the oncogene HER2 new. And so now we try to tailor the therapies based on what the molecular genetics of the cancer is telling us. And I think breast cancer has led the way. Other tumors have been slower to, you know, to identify those molecular subtypes, but I think for cancer at least, that's where the future is heading.
So this is the beginnings, really, of personalized medicine.
This is the beginnings. This is really, you know, when Obama talks about precision personalized medicine, this is where it's all heading.
I mean, let me ask you a question. I mean, the way that you do this work then is that then you take cell samples from the individuals and then go back into the laboratory and play around with medicines that are there and new medicines that might be useful specifically for that patient. Is that translational sort of research? Is that what you're involved in?
It's sort of like that, yes. I mean, so in my mind, the iterative process of research is really, even before you take the samples, is making observations and asking those questions. You know, why do some tumors go to the brain? In some patients, they only have brain metastases and not lung and liver. Why do some tumors only go to bone, not to brain and liver? And so we ask those questions and we say, you know, are there certain drivers in those tumor cells that home them to certain tissues, for example? And then we try to set up animal models or preclinical models to address those questions, and then go back into the clinic and say, now that we have hypothesis based on laboratory data, let's say it's protein A. We think that having protein A on a breast cancer cell or a lung cancer cell directs that cell to the brain. Now let's go and test that hypothesis in clinical samples. So let's get samples from patients, and let's say, does protein A in that tumor predict for a brain metastasis, or protein B predict for bone metastasis? You know, if we're lucky, our hypothesis is 10 or 15% correct in patients. So we then look at the patient information, and we say, well, you know, we were sort of correct, but not completely correct. Let's now go back into the lab and try to adjust our models and try to make it more accurate, and then go back into the clinic. And we continuously refine this from bench to bedside and from bedside back to bench and so forth until, you know, we come up with a pretty good, you know, rationale for what we think is going on. And as you mentioned, along the way, we start to think, gee, if protein A predicts for brain metastases, is there a way that we can block protein A with, you know, drugs that are either on the that are currently being used and approved by the FDA, or therapies that we're developing specifically targeted therapies, for example, to target protein A? And can we show that in animal models or preclinical laboratory models that we can prevent brain metastases? And then that sets the rationale for doing a clinical trial with the drug. It's a process. As I tell people, it's the closest thing to bipolar disease.
Well, let me ask you this question, following up. If you're screening the breast cancer, for example, and you have it into these different categories, do you know in advance that category A can be cured and category D is end? I mean, do you actually scale the types?
Well, we know that some of the categories are more responsive to therapy. So we know that breast cancers, again, for example, that are estrogen receptor positive, tend to do better because they respond to anti-estrogen therapies like tamoxifen, like aromatase inhibitors. So we know a priori that those tend to be a bit, you know, more indolent and more responsive to certain treatments, as opposed to the types of breast cancer that we tend to see more in younger women, premenopausal women, what we call the triple negative, the breast cancers that are estrogen receptor negative, progesterone receptor negative, and HER2 negative as well. Those we don't have any good therapies as yet, and that's a very active area of research. You know, so in my lifetime, in the past 20 years, I'll give you an example of, and it's an area that I've worked on in particular and developed, spent 8 years developing a targeted therapy, are the 15 to 25% of women whose breast cancers overexpress what we call an oncogene, a gene that can be directly linked to the development of that tumor, and that's called HER2, human epidermal growth factor receptor 2. Every woman who now has breast cancer gets screened for that. There's a test to determine whether that tumor overexpresses HER2. And for those, again, 15 to 25% of women, we now have, you know, five targeted therapies, these smart therapies that seek out the HER2 overexpressing cells in the body, which should only be the tumor cells, and eradicate them. And so that's a disease that when I was training as a fellow in oncology back in, you know, 1990, 1991, that was almost a uniform death sentence. So women would cry if you said you have HER2 positive breast cancer, because We knew that was highly aggressive. At that time, we didn't have good therapies. Now, flash forward 2015, women often cry when they're told they're HER2 negative because we have so many good therapies for HER2 positive breast cancers. It's just been an amazing transformation, taking, you know, essentially a death sentence to a disease that people are now talking about potentially curing. I mean, to talk about potentially curing metastatic HER2 positive breast cancer was something that I wasn't sure I'd ever hear about in my lifetime.
That's pretty amazing and good to hear. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with co-host Russ Chianelli and Dr. Neil Spector, professor of medicine from Duke. We'll be back shortly.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neisel. If you've been in rural Texas, which both Norbert and I have, there's a good chance you ran into a snake or two.
I've nearly stepped on a few. You know, up to 2 million people worldwide are bitten by snakes every year, and many die.
We're looking to an animal who can maybe help us, the opossum. These guys are resistant to snake venom because a protein in their blood binds to the toxins and neutralizes them.
Even though we've known this, only recently did a scientist actually try synthesizing this protein to make an antivenom. The problem with current antivenoms is they're hard to make and expensive.
Large amounts of venom first need to be milked from snakes, which is dangerous. Then small amounts are injected into animals such as horses and pigs for about a year. The animals' immune systems react to produce antibodies which we harvest as antivenom.
Each vial costs thousands of dollars, and some people require 20 to 30 vials to treat a single snake bite. If we could harness the protein in opossum's blood, it could provide a better alternative.
The protein, lethal toxin neutralizing factor, or LTNF, also neutralizes the plant toxin ricin and toxins produced by sea cucumbers.
Researchers were able to cheaply produce the active portion of LTNF in large quantities. Once isolated and purified, it was tested in mice and found to protect them against the venoms of western diamondback rattlesnakes and Russell's vipers.
More testing is needed to see if it can become a universal antivenom and to be sure it's safe for humans. We've yet to understand just how this little protein is so effective.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Dr. Neil Spector, professor of medicine, Duke University.
You know, in following this and then for your last comments, the techniques I hear people talk about turn off the blood supply only for the tumors. Can you say a little bit about that and how that works?
Sure. So those are called angiogenesis inhibitors. It's an area that was really thought to be the holy grail, right? If you could specifically turn off the blood supply and the nutrients for cancers, which have a rather unique regulation of their blood supply that is thought to be different from the blood supply of normal tissues, then you could selectively kill tumor cells and starve them to death. I'd say the reality is it hasn't panned out the way we thought it would. So the best example of where that therapy has worked is in colorectal cancer, where a drug called Avastin, which is an antibody against one of the growth factors that promotes the vasculature, the growth of blood vessels in tumors, is approved for therapy in men and women who have metastatic colorectal cancer. The same drug, Avastin, was approved in breast cancer. It was later withdrawn because large confirmatory clinical trials did not show the benefit that was shown very early on. It's also approved in brain tumors for the most aggressive glioblastoma. But again, it turns out like everything else that's related to tumors, because tumors, in my mind, are the penultimate survival mechanism. I mean, if we could figure out what tumors do, we'd be living to 550 years old.
Very dismal thought, I might add, right?
It's a dismal thought. Well, it depends what you look like at 550. But
why not concentrate on that research?
Well, you know, I mean, that could be another show, that if we used some of the insights into what tumors do to evade the immune system, we could probably help people, you know, who have
organs. But isn't that another technique to try to manipulate the immune system to fight off the cancers now?
That's actually the hot area now, is unleashing the immune system to do what it should be doing, which is to kill the tumor cells. So, and there are a number of, so any of the meetings you go to now, probably 80% of the meeting is devoted to what are called overcoming the immune checkpoints. The tumors have figured out how to put the brakes on the body's immune system, which, you know, for decades people have asked the question, why is it that the body's immune system doesn't do what it does in infections and other, you know, in other foreign, presence of foreign bodies? Why doesn't it recognize tumors as foreign? And now we finally have an understanding and therapies that have transformed the treatment of melanoma, even non-small cell lung cancers. I mean, it's incredible what some of these drugs are doing. So the actual taking advantage and activating the immune system, I think, has supplanted the targeting the vasculature in tumors, which, again, the latter turned out to be, you know, probably not as dramatic a therapeutic as we thought.
Let's talk about that, Neil, because there is some current concern about what I'll simply call lack of reproducibility in certain biomedical research right. data. There was a paper, I think, in Science or Nature recently where they said something like 65% of the papers dealing with oncological aspects of biomedicine were not reproducible. Now, you know, there's several ways to look at this, that there's a lot of fraud going on, or the systems are very complex, and the reagents that you use in one laboratory may ostensibly be the same, but there's small impurities. Well, what's your take on all of that? Because you're right there in the front line.
Right. So, just to clarify, I think it was even higher. My impression was it was about 80%. And it was more having to do with the high profile, so the stuff that ends up on CNN on the little ticker tape, but, you know, right. a new gene. So, and I think that's part of the nature of trying to publish in a highly competitive environment in the top journals. And that's exactly what those authors looked at, were the top tier of journals.
Yeah, Cell, Nature, and Science.
Exactly. So to get into those journals, which, you know, if you get into those journals and you publish, you're well ahead of the game to get funding for your research, and the name of the game if you're into research.
Well, until somebody publishes that they can't reproduce it.
Well, that's right.
It's a double-edged sword.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I'm not sure that paper that showed that you couldn't reproduce 80%, that there was any money withdrawn from, because there were no names mentioned in that paper. So, but what it pointed out is there's, and I'm not saying this is the entire problem, because tumors are complex. Animal models, you know, one strain of animal may be different that's used in MD Anderson from the ones that are used at Duke, from the ones used at Harvard. So there are, you know, little nuances that may explain some of these. But I think a large part of it is just that pressure. As somebody said once, if you tell a postdoc, someone who's just gotten their PhD and is looking for that first academic appointment, that faculty position, that they're one figure away from having a Cell paper, and Cell is the holy, and all they need is to have a nice figure that shows X, what is the likelihood that they're going to provide the mentor in the lab a nice figure that shows X?
It's Neil, I've got to interrupt there, because that's pretty negative. I mean, you're saying, in fact, what is becoming a rather sort of well thought of activity in the lay public, that science itself is at fault here. I mean, it's not just materials not having the purity, perhaps, but that there is a certain human sociological feature that is undermining science, and that's pretty dangerous, and then undermining medicine.
I don't know whether that's 10%, 15%, you know, I think the majority of research is credible. I think it exists. I think it's inherent. Look, this is a very difficult time for research. The research dollars are not what they used to be. The number of people, the number of PhDs we're graduating into the, you know, the workforce is increasing, and there just aren't the number of good positions for them.
We've got to interrupt you here, because I want to get on to some of your own personal experiences, but you're hitting on things which, down in the trenches where we are, where we're training people to go into PhD programs, this is it's a cause for big concern, but it's outside the scope of what we can do. But this business about medicine and where we are today, and you've had some really personalized experiences in this, and perhaps you could finish this little interview by going through quite quickly what was your brush with death, and where did the medical system sort of fail you?
So my brush with death, just to make a very 16-year journey shorter, was that I was misdiagnosed for 4 years as being stressed when, in fact, I had a very severe case of Lyme disease, which is a tick-borne illness that probably some people would say doesn't exist in Texas, although we know it does exist in Texas. I was told, here I am a physician scientist, and I told my doctors that there was something terribly wrong with me. And they kept brushing it off and saying, you're just stressed. It highlights the fact that in medicine nowadays, look, you're lucky if you could spend 10 minutes with your doctor, right? Your doctor looks at you. A lot of them are looking at the computer trying to get the electronic medical record completed by the time you leave because that's what's mandated now. So you're lucky if you get 10 minutes. You're lucky if your doctor lays any hands on you. And you're lucky if your doctor's looking at you. So, I mean, my book is, Gone in a Heartbeat. I tell him my next book is going to be The Impersonalized Nature of Personalized Medicine. Because to many people, personalized medicine means, Marcus Welby, somebody holding your hand at your bedside. Personalized medicine, and this is what happened to me, is that doctors are losing the clinical skills that they need to have. I mean, I may sound like a dinosaur, but to me, medicine will always be an art form and not a pure science, an exact science. We're all different. We need to use the tools that we have, genomics, proteomics, all these wonderful large platform technologies. But at the end of the day, it's you as a patient with your unique body, your unique physiology, your environmental exposures, the stresses in your life that are all affecting your health that need to be factored into what we do. And if doctors who... essentially, some of them failed me by really not listening to me and taking me credibly, even as a physician. So imagine what's happening to some of your listeners. If that system failed me because I didn't fit beautifully in the nice checkboxes of laboratory results, even though my clinical symptoms were very consistent with something bad and something like Lyme disease, they couldn't see beyond, the test. And the tests are imprecise, and unfortunately, we're moving in an era when everything is going to be more and more dependent upon a test. In fact, I'll give you this one example. There will be a day very soon when you go to your doctor and you might say, I have the worst headache in my life, and there will be an app on your phone, and your doctor will say, put the app against the screen, and God forbid you don't have the headache gene. Your doctor will tell you, I'm sorry, you don't have a headache. So, good luck, goodbye.
Well, there are old-fashioned doctors around. I just had to go for a checkup, and I said, it's about time I had one of these Doppler experiments to find out if my blood flow was good. So my doctor, my cardiologist, did everything. He paid a lot of attention to the bottom of my feet, pushing and listening. And I said, well, where's the big technology? He said, Keith, don't you trust in me enough? I know much more than the damned instruments do, And Abraham Verghese, are you familiar with this gentleman?
Yes.
Yeah, he wrote a great book and this is about 25 years ago, where he said, hands-on is the big issue. Doctors need to put their hands on the patient and feel and listen.
And what you just said at the end, listen.
Yes.
I trained with one of the giants of medicine, Don Seldon, who I think is still at Parkland, but was the head of medicine. What he said was, if you take a thorough history and you do a thorough physical exam, 90% of the time you'll be pointed in the right direction. You don't need MRI scans. You use those to confirm what you think, but you don't need them up front. You go to a cardiologist nowadays and you say, what's this murmur I've got? They don't even listen to your heart. They send you right for an echocardiogram.
Okay.
What is that about?
Well, Neil, we've got to stop here, but it's been fascinating talking to you, and I'd like to thank you very much, and good luck with your research and your R01s, I'm sure. And we'd like to thank the listener out there for listening, and, of course, Norma Martinez, who puts all these programs together with such skill. We'll be back next week. Take care.